The Tom Woods Show, episode 2253.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Delighted to have our old friend Kevin Gutzman back with us. He's a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University, author of numerous books of considerable importance, James Madison and the Making of America, Thomas Jefferson, Revolutionary, of course, the book we wrote together, Who Killed the Constitution? But now this one, The Jeffersonians, the Visionary Presidencies of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, released just this week. And Kevin, you've been getting such good news about this book. First, that the History Book Club made it its featured selection for, I think, January 2023. And then that nice feature in USA Today about five books people should read. And this is one of them. Of all the books out there, The Jeffersonians is one of them. It's just amazing. Good for you.
Thank you. Actually, I also learned today that it's going to be reviewed in the Wall Street Journal very soon.
This is crazy. It couldn't happen to a better guy.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now we're going to dig in here. And because the book is, let's just say the book is a, in the old days, we might have said a fat book, but that's an insensitive word these days. So it's a large book. I don't know. I don't want to try to fit it all into one episode. So we'll get you back and we'll talk about it more. But let's start off with a kind of meta question here, because although obviously there have been great many books written about Jefferson, about Madison, and indeed about Monroe, I don't know that there's been a book like this one that looks at all three of them in the course of a book. Maybe there has been. But I think people who are not historians might look at this and say, well, surely this is well-trodden ground. So the question is, what are you bringing to this that's new and fresh and different?
Well, actually, there isn't another book like this. And the reason is that that kind of classic breakpoint, or what historians call periodization, says that something ended in 1815 and then something new came after that. And my point is that Jefferson gave this inaugural address in which he laid out his party's platform, and the three of them followed the same program for the entirety of their six terms as president. They basically enacted the entire thing, most of which was a gigantic success and some of which was a huge debacle, and that's what the book's about.
All right. I want to, in fact, of course, go through that, but I want to start actually on all the way back here. I had been looking far ahead, but looking back toward the beginning. Page 23, you say numerous historians have written excellent accounts of the party conflict of the 1790s. Jefferson would one day lament in his first inaugural address, without their realizing it was happening, Madison, Hamilton, Jefferson, and eventually Washington were drawn into partisanship. At root, it resulted from differing ideas of what the American Revolution had been about. What were the differing ideas?
Well, I think the short of it is that Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, people who would have called themselves Republicans in the 1790s, thought that the Revolution had offered them an opportunity to make a new kind of society with a new kind of government. And on the other hand, people like Hamilton and Washington thought that this was an opportunity for the Americans to have a government like the British one. So in the 1790s, essentially at Congress's behest, Hamilton proposed various measures that would have assimilated the United States to the British model. And as the general program became clear, more and more people became Jeffersonians. That is, opposed what Hamilton was trying to do. It wasn't that Hamilton was sneaky about it. It wasn't that there was some personal animus. It was just that from the beginning, they had understood what the Revolution had been intended to accomplish very much differently. That's why the Republicans called themselves Republicans. The implication, of course, was Hamilton and his followers were not Republican.
That's been staring me in the face for my whole life. I never put that together until you just said it. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
Jefferson's inaugural, so his first inaugural, not the much briefer second one, but the, or is it, I'm trying to think of who who has the briefer second inaugural? Is it George Washington? It's like four sentences.
Washington's second inaugural is like three sentences.
Yeah. Okay. That's that's the way, you know, I'm more or less going to continue as I have been. And if anything goes wrong, you let me know. So
right.
Going through Jefferson's inaugural, first inaugural, you do get substance in terms of you learn, if you didn't know already, what he's all about, what his program's going to be. And at some point in this book, you pointed out that it's not particularly fashionable to dwell on his support for federalism or what we for short call states' rights. And every time you use the phrase states' rights, I get emails from libertarians. States don't have rights. It's just a shorthand expression, okay, referring to the relationship of the states vis-a-vis the federal government. And you even mentioned one historian who had gone through and listed and analyzed the various points, the various stances laid out in that address that just simply left out the states' rights part. So this is not fashionable in the history community, but you've somehow gotten away with highlighting it, and the result is apparently accolades everywhere, so that's good.
Well, the historian's name is Stephen Howard Brown. He wrote a book called Jefferson's Call for Nationhood about the first inaugural, and of course, Jefferson wasn't calling for nationhood.
No.
He was
saying the title
that he wanted a federal government.
Yeah.
And basically that the Republican victory in 1800 meant that the federal government wasn't going to be driving the states into a national existence, but that the principle of decentralization, or again, we call it federalism, that was going to be one that was favored now, Jefferson thought, by the entire country, and the government would be consistently respecting this principle from that point forth. Jefferson, of course, didn't think only that it was significant that people should respect the idea that as between the states and the federal government, the states had particular powers that had been reserved from the federal government. He also said at one point, of course, in a contest between the federal government and the states, I prefer the states. But then if the contest were between a state and the counties, I would prefer the counties. And then within the counties, I prefer what he called the wards, or what we would now call precincts. So he had the idea that if you're going to have a really democratic society, if the average Joe, who of course could not be in Congress, were going to have the maximum impact on his own life, that as many decisions as possible should be made locally. And if they couldn't be made locally, well, they ought to be made as close to locally as possible. That's really what federalism stood for. So in my book, Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, where I examine Jefferson's political program at book length, I start with this principle of federalism. I think it was his favorite one, leaving aside republicanism, which of course is a given. Jefferson thought that the average person couldn't be involved in high politics, and so we needed to decentralize the government as much as possible.
And yet, for some reason, in this day and age, we probably speculate, in this day and age, if you were to say, what are the necessary ingredients for a democratic society, they would say something like the opposite, for some reason. That we have to have one big national community, which of course strains the definition of the word community. And presumably a community is supposed to refer to a bunch of people who at least in principle could know one another, you know, at least to some degree. How can there be I'm beating a dead horse here. Can you lay out what is the Jeffersonian program?
Well, first there's this federalism principle. Then there's the idea that America should pursue a peaceful foreign policy because the alternative to that, like the alternative to federalism, meant centralization of power, taking wealth away from average people and having it be spent by a connected few. And then, of course, once you got into wars, you had more wars. Once you had allies, you had their wars. Once you started spending money on military causes, you ended up with more concentration of wealth in the society, and this was just undesirable per se. So he wanted a peaceful foreign policy insofar as that was possible. He also said that, of course, if there were a war, well, a Republican society's first reliance should be on the militia. The citizenry should be trained to arms. And here we can note that Jefferson had in mind that students at his university, the University of Virginia, would practice every day with their arms together. He wanted American citizens to be citizens. I think he had kind of the ancient Greek or ancient Roman Republican model in mind for this. And he wanted peace, commerce, and honest friendship with all nations, entangling alliances with none, he said. He wanted to try to incorporate the American Indians into American society because he thought American Indians were equal, but he thought they had backward civilization and they would benefit from being folded into the greater American population. And of course, he had similar personal opinions about blacks, but he didn't really address that question in the inaugural address. So ultimately, there would be an educated polity, and it would be an armed polity, and it wouldn't have an elite, it wouldn't have an aristocracy, it wouldn't have an established professional military, because that would lead to concentration of wealth and more wars than otherwise there might be, and wars should be avoided. So people who were left free to trade peacefully would maximize their own prosperity, and that's what he hoped they would be allowed to do. That's what he actually foresaw Americans doing, now that finally, as he understood it, the Federalist menace had been vanquished.
At one point in the book, you have a very pithy explanation of the way Jefferson looked at the relationship between borrowing, like government borrowing, taxes, and war, and how they mutually reinforce each other. Can you recap that?
Well, I don't recall the pithy part.
All the time you need then.
Well, certainly he thought that if you had war, government would borrow. And if government borrowed, it would borrow from the wealthy. And that would mean paying interest to the wealthy. And so there would be more concentration of society's wealth in the hands of a few. And this was, of course, undesirable. Then there would be interference in the country's overseas trade, which would reduce the society's wealth in general, and there would be a diversion of American manpower from peaceful pursuits into essentially wasteful wartime pursuits. And so there just was nothing to favor about this. This way of understanding this general question was not original to Jefferson. It actually was from English opposition writers a century earlier, I think.
Well, I noticed that you made brief reference to a historian named Herb Sloan, who's done some work on the subject of Jefferson and his views on debt. And my eyes, rather than my ears, my eyes pricked up a bit with that because he was one of my professors at Columbia. And he just died last month, actually, Herb Sloan.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
He was actually a close friend of my PhD advisor, Peter Onuf.
Oh, how about that? Okay. Yeah, he seemed to know all the relevant people, and he was a nice enough guy. And the funny thing was, he didn't look the part at all. You put a hat on him, he's a cab driver.
Right.
But then you start talking to him and wow, he really knows everything. But was there a sense that, and I'm just trying to remember his thesis on this, did it have to do with trying to claim that Jefferson's view of government debt as a public policy matter derived to some degree from his own personal experiences with debt?
Well, I think it was reinforced by his own personal experiences with debt. But anybody who had been an opposition thinker before or during the American Revolution would have encountered what Robbins called the 17th century Commonwealth men, and that they were people who thought essentially that having war was a way of transferring wealth from the many to the few. So that's one reason to avoid it. That's why I said this wasn't original Jefferson. He was one of many. I think Sam Adams had the exact same idea about that. And they both got it from English writers who were popular with the few opposition people in England, and then with the leading radicals in the United States.
Let's switch gears. I want to ask you about the Danbury Baptist Association. You had to know this was coming. What was interesting in your book was to note that what Jefferson had to say to them was not, at the time, really talked about or thought much about or written about or paid much attention to, whereas today, thanks to the Supreme Court, this particular episode of the history of Jefferson's presidency takes on outsized relevance. So what is this all about?
Oh, boy. Well, Connecticut, of course, was founded by people from Massachusetts, by Puritans, among whom was John Winthrop's son. And the purpose of Connecticut was to be more of Massachusetts. So the idea was that this place was going to, I'm actually sitting in Danbury as we speak. The idea was this place was going to be a Puritan Commonwealth. And by the time Jefferson was president, there were dissenters to the general establishment in Connecticut, which of course controlled not only the religious life of the state, but also the economic life, the social life, and so on, the university, Yale, and so on. So these people were persecuted. They had various disabilities. They didn't get economic business from the wealthy in the state. They had various political disabilities too. And so when Jefferson was elected, they, knowing that he had been the father of the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, sent him a letter telling him how pleased they were at this development and that they hoped eventually Connecticut would follow Virginia's model or something like that. And Jefferson had an idea that if you were the chief executive of the state or of the United States, one way that you could communicate with the general populace was by sending pithy statements of important principles to particular groups or individuals. And so he had in mind, for example, in something like the letter to the Danbury Baptists, that Americans in general would learn what his position was and that he would be instructing people that in general, the government shouldn't be discriminating against, in this case, religious dissenters. And he said that he hoped eventually that Connecticut would follow other states in allowing freedom of religion, which it did in 1818. I have a feeling I left something out. Was that an answer to your whole question?
Well, why does this matter today? Because it does matter today.
It's an interesting chapter in the intellectual history of the United States. There was a Supreme Court justice from the New Deal until 1970, I think, named Hugo Black, who before Franklin Roosevelt appointed him to the Supreme Court had been the chief friend of New Deal legislation in the U.S. Senate. And before he'd been a senator, he had been a state judge in Alabama and a member of the Ku Klux Klan. In fact, he was elected to the U.S. Senate after a campaign in which the head of the Alabama Klan traveled around the state with him and spoke for him before he made speeches himself. And in those days, the Klan was the second Klan, the one that came to be in the 1910s. Well, so anyway, we had first Klan after the Civil War, and then it kind of disappeared. And then in the 1910s, a new Klan was born, and it didn't only hate blacks, it also hated Catholics and various other people. And it didn't like the idea of established religion or reading particular kinds of Bibles in school, or there were various things about church and state that the second Klan stood for. And I think this idea that Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptists is constitutional law, which is the fruit of Hugo Black's efforts on the Supreme Court, I think this actually is the instantiation of Ku Klux Klan's position on this question in American constitutional law. It doesn't have any close resemblance to what people thought they were doing when they made the Establishment Clause, which of course was only supposed to be a limitation on the federal government. You and I dealt with that in Who Killed the Constitution.
So what exactly, though, is the Ku Klux Klan's view of this question?
Well, the Klan was unhappy, and I guess if there are any Klansmen left, they're probably still unhappy with various kinds of government support for religion, because they didn't want in particular for the government to be paying for people to go to Catholic schools, as in general they thought that it should remain the case that American public schools were Protestant, as they always had been. And there was a kind of movement among American Catholics and some other people in the 1930s when Black was put on the Supreme Court by Roosevelt that the possibility was out there that you could end up with Catholic schools getting state support, or you could end up with majority Catholic communities having Catholic Bible read in the morning instead of, I guess, the King James, or, you know, it could end up with some kind of camel's nose under the tent flap of Catholicism in American public schooling. And that's why Black liked the idea that, well, this letter from Jefferson to the Danbury Baptists saying that through the Establishment Clause, the American people had established, quote, a wall of separation between church and state, was congenial to Black, not only as written, but as, quote unquote, incorporated into the 14th Amendment and thereby made enforceable against state governments. So in general, since the 1930s, 40s, we've add more and more of the enforcement of this principle. I know when I was a high school student in Texas, class of 81, Belton High School, class of 81, we had an annual baccalaureate service that was associated with the graduation ceremony, where they had the local ministers rotate in leading prayers at this more or less religious service. And then we also had prayers by rotating ministers before football games. They come on the loudspeaker and pray that none of our boys get hurt tonight and that kind of thing. And nowadays, the court, following Black's reasoning, has decided that all of this kind of stuff is unconstitutional. So in theory, it's not allowed. In practice, it still happens, but it's not supposed to be happening. And that all gets back to Black's idea that Jefferson's statement about a wall of separation between church and state, number one, somehow has something to do with the First Amendment, remember, which Jefferson had nothing to do with writing or ratifying, and secondly, is enforceable against state governments, which, again, even if you just read the First Amendment, you see it's not about state governments. So that's why I said this is an interesting chapter in the intellectual history of America. You could say it's a peculiar chapter. Maybe they'll get around to undoing this now that we seem to have a majority on the Supreme Court that actually cares about this kind of thing.
Hey, folks, quick message from Moel Woods here. If you are looking to add Bitcoin to your retirement account and thinking about the long haul, then the best and easiest way to do that is with BitTrust IRA. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. It stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. I've often said that if Bitcoin is ever to gain more widespread acceptance, it's going to have to be more user-friendly, and BitTrust IRA could not be easier to use. So go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners, a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. A couple more things I definitely want to hit on in this first episode with you, but I like the personal touches here. This is not exclusively just a political history. For example, the letters that Jefferson received on the death of his daughter are quite beautiful. And then his responses are very nice, but particularly the letter from Abigail Adams at a time when his relationship with, quote, the Adams family was a little bit strained. She couldn't help but write and say something. And he was fairly gracious in his response, but couldn't help noting that, I wish those midnight appointments hadn't happened. The judicial appointments, just as John Adams was leaving, I took that as personally unkind. So actually, let's say a little something about that. So as the John Adams administration is coming to a close, talk about what was the point of these so-called midnight appointments, and how do they relate to Marbury versus Madison in 1803?
Well, okay, so there are several things here. First is that the Adamses and Jefferson had been very close friends. And then came the Adams administration. Of course, Jefferson is the titular head of the opposition. And he narrowly lost the election of 1796 to Adams and then narrowly defeated Adams in 1800. Apparently, he intended kind of to make that up with Adams. In fact, I note in the book that what isn't commonly mentioned, that in his first inaugural, in the draft of it, in one draft of it that we have, Jefferson not only said nice things about his predecessor, George Washington, he also said nice things about his predecessor, John Adams. But then what happened was that Adams, rather than attending the ceremony as Washington had attended Adams' ceremony, his inauguration, Adams and Mrs. Adams just rode out of town. So Jefferson apparently lined that out of his inaugural address, the part where he was going to have a little encomium to John Adams. And he, of course, was right that the reason for the appointment of the so-called midnight judges, that is, the judges whose offices had been created by the outgoing congressional majority during the lame duck session after Jefferson defeated Adams in the election of 1800 and subsequent voting in the House, The reason for that was to provide an obstacle to enactment of the Republican program. In fact, Gouverneur Morris, who was a Federalist senator at the time, said that was the reason why they were doing this. So Jefferson knew that was the reason why they'd done this, and he thought this was not cricket, and he told Mrs. Adams that. But Mrs. Adams actually also had known his, she'd known both of his daughters, Maria and Martha, and when the younger of them died, she apparently just couldn't stand it, and so she, as you said, wrote Jefferson a very nice letter saying how much she missed the girl and how sad she was for Jefferson and what a terrible loss this must be for him. And she wanted him to know that she was sorry about it too. And it led to a lengthy correspondence between the two of them. Apparently, John Adams didn't know the correspondence was happening until the very last, I think there were maybe four letters from Jefferson, three from Adams, or maybe three from each, I can't recall. But anyway, when she got to the last of the letters, there was a P.S. from John Adams saying, Mrs. Adams showed these letters to me last night. I have nothing to add. So he wanted Ed Jefferson to know that he had read them too. But in any event, the Federalist judiciary, of course, had not been voted out in 1800 because there was no way to vote them out. And Jefferson thought this was a flaw in the Constitution, that you should have one branch of the federal government still devoted to principles that the American people had rejected, and ended up butting heads with them in various ways, some of which were entirely on his own initiative, some of which were the Federalist judges doing. And in general, by the time you got to the end of the fracas between the Republicans and the Federalist judges, you could say that the Federalist judges had probably won. The Republicans had won all the political battles, but the Federalist judges won the war, because today, if you take constitutional law, whether it's in high school, college, law school, grad school, you're going to start by reading Marbury versus Madison, and then comes McCulloch versus Maryland, and then come four or five more of John Marshall's opinions that are all completely anti-Jeffersonian. So this remains the basis of the way people understand the U.S. Constitution, at least officially now. That's part of course, what the book argues against, but it's a forlorn hope that that would change, I think.
So the circumstances that led to Marbury, how do they relate exactly to these appointments?
Well, okay, so in those days, again, there was a presidential election. The members of the Electoral College in all the states sent their results in, and there was a ceremony like the one famously held on January 6, 2021, where the vice president counted the ballots, and then people knew who had been elected president. Actually, it took quite a while because it turned out that Jefferson and Burr had tied, and so the matter had to go into the House of Representatives, where each state had one vote, and then it took 30-odd ballots before finally people agreed that Jefferson was the winner and Burr would be vice president. And during the lame duck session of Congress between the election and the new president being sworn in, the outgoing Federalist majority created new judicial posts, knowing that if they staffed them with Federalists, there would be no way under the Constitution that the president could easily remove them. The only provision for removal of such a person in the Constitution is that Congress has to impeach and convict him, which when it comes to Supreme Court justices has never happened. Although I do tell the story in the book of the only impeachment of a Supreme Court justice and of the trial, which is a very interesting little period in American history. But essentially, as Gouverneur Morris said, Federalists could establish kind of break on Republican policy by setting up these new judgeships and then staffing them with Federalists. Although one thing that's mythical about that is the idea that everybody who was put in one of these posts was a Federalist. My friend Richard Samuelson, who's a professor at one of the California State University campuses, notes that at least one of them was actually a Republican. So how that happened is unclear. But
what is the right and wrong about not delivering the, what's the word?
To the commission.
Yeah.
The commission.
Like, so what is the right and wrong of that?
So William Marbury was one of these quote-unquote midnight judges, one of the people whose positions were created between the election and the inauguration while the outgoing Federalists still controlled Congress and John Adams was still the president. And they created several new judgeships, and then John Adams chose people to hold them, and he filled out commissions, which are the official papers saying that somebody has a high federal post. And so, you know, if you're a colonel in the army, or if you're a marshal in a federal court, or if you have any kind of an appointed post in the federal government, you get a commission. And when Jefferson was an old man, when he was in his 70s, after his political career, he wrote what's called his autobiography, although it's almost entirely political. It's not really what we'd think of as an autobiography. He says that when he went to Washington, he went into the State Department, and there on the Secretary of State's desk, he found a stack of commissions, and he said, "I instantly determined not to deliver them." So what Jefferson thought was that this was like a deed for a sale of land. And if you have a land sale, you can have agreement, and the person who owns the land can sign a deed changing title from himself to the buyer. But if the buyer doesn't have the paper in his hand, if he doesn't own it, that is, if it hasn't been given to him by the old owner of the land, the sale legally never happened. So Jefferson thought, if I don't deliver these commissions, these appointments haven't happened. The Constitution says the president can appoint high officials of the executive and judicial branches with the advice and consent of the Senate. So in Marbury versus Madison, Chief Justice Marshall said that all that were necessary for vesting a federal judgeship in someone was that the president should name the person and the Senate should give its advice and consent. Notice this doesn't include delivering the commission. That's what the issue was. And the reason why this became a political flap, the only reason why the Republicans really cared about what Marshall had done in Marbury versus Madison was that nowadays, if you go to law school, one of the very first things you learn is that if you're in federal court, the first thing you have to explain to the judge is why he has jurisdiction. He's not going to hear anything else until you convince him that he has jurisdiction over the case. In America, state courts can hear any kind of case, but a federal court can only hear certain kinds of cases. So they're what are called courts of special jurisdiction. So you have to tell him, first of all, why he has jurisdiction. And what Marshall did in his opinion for the court in Marbury versus Madison was he started with the question whether Marbury had a right to this thing, whether there was a remedy at law, with blah, blah, blah. And then finally, he got to the question, well, do we have jurisdiction? In other words, what he did was he allowed himself to read a long lecture about the misdeeds of Secretary of State Madison. And of course, really, it was Jefferson who was not delivering the commission, not Madison, but he blasted Madison in the lawsuit. And only at last did he get to the question, do we have jurisdiction over this case? And then he famously decided, no, we don't, because the federal law that purported to give it to us in this kind of case is invalid. It's unconstitutional. That's why Marbury versus Madison stands for the principle that federal courts can decide that federal statutes are unconstitutional. That's what makes it important. The question whether Marbury had a right to be a JP in DC didn't matter to anybody, really.
Yeah, I suppose not. And of course, obviously, what people are looking at in Marbury versus Madison is the precedent that it sets in terms of exactly what you said, the federal courts being able to make those kinds of determinations. I just want to know, just as a matter of curiosity, who was in the right on that matter? I mean, what side should I take on it?
Well, I tend to think that Jefferson was right, that the commission had to be delivered. But it's not obvious. It seems to be the case. If you're selling somebody your house and you sign the papers and then you decide not to deliver them, you haven't actually sold your house, right? So, and that's what the law is, Jefferson rightly pointed out in his quote-unquote autobiography. And that was essentially his position when it came to these petty court positions too. And I think that's also true. If the president signs a commission and decides, I'm not going to give it to that guy after all, the guy's not entitled to it.
All right, last thing before we get going. I think you might have a slightly different view than a lot of people on this question, let's say in the conservative and libertarian worlds, who will say that Marbury versus Madison was just a usurpation, that there is no grounds for the idea of judicial review at the federal level. But I'm pretty sure your argument has been that in the background, you can see that a great many people kind of took for granted that the federal courts would have this power. So what are the rights and wrongs of this?
Well, we know that in at least two states during the ratification campaigns, federalists said that federal judges were going to have the power of judicial review. In Virginia, Patrick Henry, the chief anti-federalist, said something to the effect of, "We should be so lucky." And I don't know of anybody who argued that that wouldn't be true among the federalists. So besides that, if the Supremacy Clause, which says that this Constitution, laws and treaties made pursuant to it, is supreme law of the land, if it doesn't mean that the Constitution is superior to laws and treaties made pursuant to the Constitution, what does it mean? Like, what is the judge supposed to do? I've never really understood the complaint or the objection to it from some few conservatives and a higher portion of libertarians. Do you want federal judges to see that a statute is unconstitutional, clearly unconstitutional, and go ahead and enforce it? Is that your preference? I mean, what is the point?
But maybe the complaint is the misuse of it, where they can't see a thing wrong with the federal government, but they spend their time going after completely innocuous things on the state level.
Well, of course, I agree with that. But the problem here is that there's not a sufficient check provided by the Constitution on federal judges. We had, again, during the ratification campaign, we had promise from people like Alexander Hamilton and the Federalists that this impeachment power will be, in public opinion, will be sufficient checks on federal judges to prevent them from overreaching. And we've also concocted other ones like jurisdiction stripping. And there are some things you can do if you want to limit the powers of federal courts. But essentially, it's turned out that the impeachment power is basically worthless against Supreme Court justices. I tell the story in the book of the only impeachment ever of a Supreme Court justice. And actually, the guy deserved to be impeached. He deserved to be removed. And he was acquitted, which is just painful. Jefferson said, "Well, we've proven that impeachment is a scarecrow." I think I quote him to that effect in the book. So that is a shame. But again, the fact that federal judges have come to exercise far more power than we think the Constitution justifies, or that anybody who was involved in making it contemplated, doesn't mean the Constitution isn't superior to an unconstitutional statute. Does it mean that? Is that even relevant? I don't really get the argument.
Well, the last thing would be, when we listen to you describe the Jeffersonian program, you know, a peaceful foreign policy, avoiding debt, keeping taxes low, things of this nature. This
sounds like another country, doesn't it?
Yeah, another planet, really. So it's weird for historians, most of whom really can't get on board for any of this, have to do their work writing about this guy. It's as if the Jeffersonian tradition has disappeared in America. And yet, the silver lining, though, that, I mean, if I were to look around and find some semblance of it, it would be in what happened over the past few years. And I've said this quite a few times, that I just thought American federalism was more or less dead. And then suddenly, when COVID came along, it was possible for the various states to go their own way. Now, the states are also made up of idiots, so not that many of them did. But some of them did. And in doing so, they did something very important for the world. They showed the world that apparently, if you don't do any of these crazy lockdown measures, you have pretty much the same outcome. Well, we needed that, and we wouldn't have had that if we hadn't had federalism. So Jefferson yet lives in a way.
That's true. On the other hand, we've heard people who run the intellectual part of our society, so much as it is intellectual, complaining about this, right? Complaining about the states that didn't do lockdowns. And of course, where I live in Connecticut, there's also huge political blowback against the fact that the Supreme Court recently said, you know, it's really up to the states to decide how to regulate abortion, right? People in the state legislatures were saying, oh, no, it can't be, which Of course, it's the perfectly Jeffersonian solution to the problem. Why should people in Idaho, Louisiana, and Connecticut have to have the same abortion law? They don't want the same abortion law. So there's a really weird impulse people have their policy preferences be enforced on other people whose states they've never even seen. It doesn't make sense to me. But anyway, I think actually it's a wonderful development that the court decided the states can have whatever abortion policy they like. That's what the Constitution means. That's what the 10th Amendment says. It's not even really questionable that that's the way people understood this kind of issue when the Constitution was made. And certainly that you're familiar with my book on Jefferson's political program, Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary. I start with the longest chapter on federalism and show that this was, after republicanism, which is a given, this was his main principle, right? Things should be decided locally. And if they can't be decided locally, well, certainly at the state level, not at the federal level.
Yeah, that is the principle that runs through it all. And in fact,
why would anybody oppose that? It doesn't even make sense.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, unless it's a matter of, if we're being honest, we think the general public is a bunch of stupid rubes, and we feel like at the federal level, the smart technocrats are ensconced there. And it's better for them to just tell the stupid rubes how they should live. I think that is what it is.
Maybe.
I don't know what else to, or they just don't realize that's an option. I look at all these young kids who have never been taught anything about U.S. history or the Constitution or federalism or local control or anything. And they really think that the government should do X or Y. And by the government, of course, they mean the federal government. It just never dawns on them there's another way to live, another way to make decisions or to have a meeting of the minds with your neighbors and try and sort things out. No, we'll let the judges sort things out for us, except not those judges. All of a sudden, we've decided we don't like the judges anymore. The whole thing's ridiculous. If you had just let the states just be states in the first place, you wouldn't have had these problems. You know, you wouldn't have gotten your hopes up that forever technocrats could dictate to the whole country. I mean, doesn't
all
have
true.
To be that.
All true. Yeah.
All right. Well, look, we have so much more to we barely got through the first half of Jefferson's presidency because we haven't even covered the Louisiana Purchase, which is very important. Not to mention Madison and Monroe. So we're gonna get you back because obviously USA Today is telling me this is one of the most urgent books for people to read. Who am I to question that? So I, of course, will link to it at tomwoods.com/2253. The book, again, is The Jeffersonians, The Visionary Presidencies of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe. Well, best of luck with it, Kevin, and I'm so glad it's already getting all this recognition just as it's barely been released. So just tremendous news. If only Who Killed the Constitution had gotten this kind of attention, we would really be getting places. But good for you, and I can't wait to get you back.
Well, I enjoyed it, Tom.
All right, folks, that is another episode of the Tom Woods Show. I will see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.